What you're about to listen to may include some potty talk. Then again, it may not. I hope it does, though.
It's Wednesday, August 28th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Lauren Ober, sitting in for the inimitable, the irreplaceable, the singular talent that is Mike Pesca. A little word about me. I'm the host of Spectacular Failures, a podcast all about the biggest fails in business history. But perhaps more illustriously, I was a guest on this very podcast on July 19th, 2019. So I guess that kind of means I know what I'm doing. Not really, but whatever. Anyway, regular listeners will know that this is the part of the show where Mike freewheels into some brilliant riff about something in the news that has stuck in his craw. He makes all kinds of clever arguments that wend their way on a path that eventually leads you, the listener, to a sparkling interview with an interesting talker. I'm going to do something a little different. I'm going to ask you a question. And that question is, did you know that Chelsea Manning is in jail? Or rather, did you know that she's in jail again? Because I didn't, but I found out recently thanks to the computer, and I have to say, it made me feel some kind of way. Given our Whiplash news cycle, you'd be forgiven if you'd forgotten all about Chelsea Manning. I kind of had too. I just figured at this point, Chelsea Manning would be finishing up her memoir, consulting on a movie about her life, and raking in speaker's fees, giving keynotes about that time she went to prison for leaking classified military documents to WikiLeaks. What she is actually doing is sitting in the Alexandria, Virginia City Jail, where she's been held for more than 160 days on contempt charges. Manning has refused to testify in two federal grand jury investigations of WikiLeaks, the Julian Assange-fronted anti-secrecy machine. For her defiance, she was ordered to be held without bail for as long as the grand jury is seated, which could be 18 months. On top of that, the judge in the case slammed Manning with a $1,000 a day fine for every day she doesn't agree to testify. Her lawyers estimate the fines could add up to $500,000 before all this is said and done. So until the grand jury wraps up, Manning has been taking correspondence college courses and reading letters sent to her by her supporters. She's also been tweeting, though not that often, because jail. Now, I'm not condemning or endorsing Manning's original crimes or her current grand jury resistance. A whistleblower's got to do what a whistleblower's got to do. But what I can't get over is how this 5'2" trans woman continues to stand on principle and live her convictions at the greatest personal cost to herself. As her previous gender, she was marked as an enemy of the state. Now she is a trans turncoat, doubly disloyal, if you will. She is seen in some circles as both a gender traitor and a traitor to the cause of American freedom. The only way the stakes could be higher would be if she denounced NASCAR or Bud Light or other things Americans love. So Manning's resistance makes no logical sense. There is something that happens for a lot of people when they come out, an inability to suffer inauthenticity and subterfuge. If you've been closeted, you bear the scars of secrecy. Once you're out, hiding things becomes not only tedious, but also triggering. Like, oh, hell no, I'm not going back in there. No, ma'am. So as former Army Private Chelsea Manning sits in Alexandria City Jail, I wonder if part of her motivation for standing so firm in the face of the full might of the American government is that it cannot be any other way. She can't bend to a system that doesn't feel exactly right to her. That imperative overrides everything. Manning has long stated that she believes the grand jury process to be an unethical judicial instrument shrouded in secrecy that denies witnesses, particularly political activists, their constitutional rights. And she has every right to feel that way, especially if she's called to be one of those witnesses. But that feeling comes with consequences, really big ones. I would guess that that never again post-closet impulse is in part what is motivating Manning's resistance, which essentially means that it is Manning's transness that has allowed her to persevere. None of the decisions she's made up to this point make survival sense, so her motivation must be the result of a deeper, more fundamental urge. I can tell you from personal experience, the shadows super suck. Living the light is so much better. I guess even if that light only comes through a jail cell window. On the show today, it's chock-a-block full of women, so strap in, men. I spiel about political lady fashion and how the six female presidential contenders are changing the clothing game. But first, I talked to writer Vanessa Gregoriadis about America's first daughter and possible future presidential candidate herself, Ivanka Trump. Here's that.
Everybody, I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So, Vanessa Gregoriadis, host of Tabloid, The Making of Ivanka Trump. Welcome to The Gist with Mike Pesca, which is actually just featuring me, Lauren Ober, who is not Mike Pesca.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad it's you. No, I love Mike.
Thank you. Thank you. So I first came across your podcast because I read your article in New York Magazine, your cover piece, Ivanka to City, Drop Dead, Friends, Frenemies, She'll Never Move Back. Who needs New York society anyway? Next stop, Global Princess. It was so interesting to me. And one thing that really stuck out to me as I was reading this is how many times, and you get into this in the podcast, how many times Ivanka has morphed. I mean, she was a daddy's girl and then like a teen scenester and a moody rebel. And like she hiked, you know, she went hiking for 2 weeks by herself. And then she's a tailored businesswoman. And you make the point sort of closer to the end of the piece, like now she's this diplomat princess. And I wonder, you know, she's not even 40 years old. How are there so many personalities in one person? And was that something that you were like, oh, I have to unpack, like, you know, the many faces of Ivanka for this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you talk to people, they talk about the different voices she does and how weird it is. Like you're sitting with her and then she turns into that bot that you see on TV.
Yes, totally.
Or like a guy who had been on a construction site with her was like, she'll be like, get her done. And like speak in this like weird construction site voice. And then the people who party with her, like there's like, they're just blah, 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 like this chattery voice, you know, like, and I don't know. I mean, I guess I do different voices too, but I just don't think that's something that people would note when they were like, if a reporter came to talk to them, they wouldn't be like, oh yeah, that girl, she talks in like 1,000 different voices. So mm-hmm. I thought that was bizarre. I also like, I kept talking to people and I've really rarely had this situation. And I've interviewed and profiled and right around profiled many people, like, you know, Madonna, Monica Lewinsky, Ariana Huffington, like Britney, like across the spectrum of like female stars. I've never really had the experience where I talked to 60 people and yeah, most of them fell in like kind of one bucket. But I would say the closer that you got in and the more you got to people who really knew her and were willing to tell you the truth, the more bizarrely different the impressions were of her.
Right.
Like this person who used to be close with her hates her guts. This other person absolutely loves her. Everybody agrees, though, the problem with her is her father.
Right. Well, so one thing that you were talking about is sort of, you know, that Donald Trump is Ivanka's rosebud, right? It's, you know, this is the thing I have to deal with. And it seems to me this sort of Electra complex, daddy's girl cliche thing, it almost seems like she's too good for that. Like, she should be savvier than that, or at least go to therapy. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so it's a thing that is so obvious to everybody. Both, like, I mean, it seemed like, from listening to your show, like, it was a theme that kept coming up. It is something that you can sort of just look at in sort of her speech patterns, or the way that she almost models herself after him in this weird way. And so that, I don't know. I mean, do you think, like, girl, come on, you're better than this?
I did, but I always thought it was about their relationship being some sort of, like, very close but somewhat demented relationship, uh-huh. Right? Where it was like, you know, he was only loving to her, et cetera, et cetera. Because the leaks we've gotten from the White House, right, are that, right, you know, he calls her baby and he wants her in meetings and he's, you know, affectionate to her in a way that he's not to other people.
Right.
You know, but I think that's relative because, like, around her friends growing up, they were like, this guy is, like, as distant as a dad could be.
Right.
You know, I mean, I had somebody say to me, like, her childhood friends are her family because her real family was not fucking there for her.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That she learned about her parents' divorce, like, from photographers coming and standing outside her school.
So sad.
And asking her questions is really sad. And so I think that it doesn't really do much for us because the way that she's acting, she's obviously complicit, but there's a degree to which she's kind of complicit and trapped, which is the way she's been really for her whole life. Mm-hmm. There's just no really harsher environment than the one that she grew up in. You know, that was another thing that I really think is, like, the only way to think about her is to think about the dynasty aspect and the way in which she has become invested in that, and that her dad is becoming invested in that. Because I think the thing that happened at the G20, which totally blew up in her face, and I'm sure she is totally embarrassed by it because she's really thin-skinned, kind of like her dad, is what's like some sort of audition for, like, the UN ambassadorship.
Right.
You know, like, for taking Nikki Haley's role, which, you know, people said she would love. Obviously, she would love that. Like, anything that kind of gets her into that princess diplomat, you know, high above the clouds area is, you know, that's what she's going for. Like, right, she's done with the Manhattan elite. She's on the Davos elite now.
When you have people, you know, descend down from New York who are, you know, nouveau riche society people who went to all the right schools, who are doing just fine in their own business, right? I mean, and I say that
well,
in quotes.
I don't think Jared was doing just fine.
Right. But I'm saying, yeah. but like they have a certain degree of status. I guess, like, I'm always wondering, like, what's the play? And you know, you talk about this, you allude to this, you know, the sort of Ivanka presidency 2024, which, like, has me, like, clutching all of my pearls. but I do think that you're right. But who does want to be president? Because to me, you know, being president isn't lining your pockets. You know, I mean, later maybe, but, like, you know, when Donald Trump gets out of office, he could very well go to jail and might not be making a lot of money there.
Yeah.
But so what do you think this sort of motivation is?
I mean, I think that, you know, what people said to me is her motivation isn't really money. It's just power. It's just greed. It's just grabbing everything. She just wants to grab everything. And I think she has this authenticity problem. So I don't know how she would really do as a politician. But if you start gaming it out, which Gabe Sherman and I do in one of the podcast mm-hmm. episodes, like, okay, what exactly is going to happen? She's not going to go back to the Trump org with her brothers.
Right.
That's not going to work. I mean, if he wins again, I mean, Lord help us, you know, I guess she'll just stick around there.
Right.
But if she could, like, you know, get some $100 billion real estate fund from MBS to run, mm-hmm. and she and Jared could just run it, and then they could just be, like, people who go to the Middle East a lot and who are on yachts and, like, hang out with, you know, kind of Euros and mm-hmm. ex-royals and people like that. Or she could move to Florida.
You know, in you're very well sourced in the podcast. I mean, you said you talked to, you know, like 60 some people, and a lot of them are people from her past who have, you know, very particular memories of her childhood, and a lot of them made me really, really sad. Can you talk a little bit about the lemonade stand? Because that was something that I was like, oh, it's both sad and says a lot about how they think business works.
Right. So when Ivanka was like, you know, 6 or 7 years old, they decided to have this lemonade stand at their house in Greenwich, Connecticut, which was like, you know, a big house because she couldn't have a lemonade stand at Trump Tower. It's like on Fifth Avenue. But obviously every kid wants to have a lemonade stand once, right? So
sure.
Okay, they're going to do it. And Donald and Ivana are like, okay, you can do it. But they were always like very frugal with the kids, maybe because Donald like doesn't want to give anybody any money.
Right.
But, you know, Ivana was also like, you know, from a communist country and they wanted to show them the value of money. I mean, this is everybody said this is kind of true. So Donald and Ivana are like, okay, you can set up a lemonade stand and we're going to give you like the ice and the lemons and the this and the that. But, you know, you have to reimburse us for all of that out of the profits. So the kids are like, okay. So they set up the whole lemonade stand. But then they're like, oh, my God, we're on a cul-de-sac. Like, there's nobody coming to our house. There's nobody walking by. And now we have to pay our parents back. And they're like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Oh, here's an idea. The staff can buy the lemonade or have the maid buy the lemonade. They always had bodyguards, right? Yeah. Like Donald always wanted to have bodyguards around. So like the bodyguards can buy the lemonade. The driver can buy the lemonade. They're just like, and
so insane.
Ivanka tells this story herself in that self-help book I was talking about how great she was when she was a little kid and learning the value of money. And when we read this, like my producer and I were just like ripping our hair out. We're like, ah, how can she think that this is like a cute anecdote about like understanding the value of a dollar?
Right.
Like, but that's, I mean, this is the world this girl comes from. I agree. There is a lot of sad stuff in there. I almost like argued against being so tragic, but then when you look at her childhood, it like really, it just, yeah, it has to be portrayed that way because it was that way.
Well, right. And I mean, this sort of psychology of it is, it's plain for everyone to see. But then it's also like, well, you know, she hasn't risen above that or figured out how to sort of tame that or use it to her advantage. It's just like all this childhood trauma. You know, I haven't really touched on this sort of the divorce. And that was another thing that I was amazed about in Tabloid is you talk to Ivana Trump, the matriarch of the family until the family dissolved. What, I mean, obviously they have a fractured relationship, but how did you get her to chat with you? Because I feel like even if they don't have a great relationship, like, you know, Ivana doesn't play around.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I knew a bunch of people who, you know, knew people in that circle, basically. And I also think, like, they are always going to just tell you exactly what the Trump family line is.
Yeah.
And she did. Like, they have their stories that they tell over and over and over. And they are all about how close everybody is and how they're, like, a quirky group of hardy people who are much better than the rest of, like, New York society. And they have really good values. Mm-hmm. Like, that's their line all the time. And so that's basically what I heard from her. I mean, I think the thing about Ivanka is like, there is some degree of like, she has a work ethic, right? They did impart that to her. Like there were things that she learned. Take care of family loyalty, right? That's something that's really, really important for her, to her. But it's that issue of the lemonade stand over and over. Like I was talking to somebody recently who was saying that he had been out to dinner with her and Jared. And, you know, this is when you know, she was flying around to all the third world countries to build Trump hotels with all of these really awesome oligarchs. Mm-hmm. And Jared was saying, oh, she's doing so amazing. She's seeing how far she can take the Trump name. It's incredible. And Ivanka was like, yeah, I'm flying to Georgia tomorrow morning. And the guy was like, do you mean like Buckhead, Georgia?
Right.
And he's like, no, Georgia, the country, I'm going to build a hotel there.
Right.
And he was just like, what? like at what point when you're that person, when you're Ivanka Trump, do you say to yourself like, okay, maybe this isn't like going to go down in a way that is going to be compliant with all the rules.
I wonder, you know, in your, you know, this is an interesting story for you because I feel like it's this nexus of politics and celebrity, but it's very particular. It's like a very New York story, but also of a very particular time period, but trying to sort of grow beyond that. But now we're in a place where, you know, it isn't just palace intrigue, right? It's actually like there are true implications to her political involvement and her sort of insertion into this administration. I wonder, like, what have you gleaned about her, you know, about her involvement from the reporting you've done and sort of what the knock-on effect, if any, will be from her, you know, pushing herself into this role?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the line is she's meaningless, right?
Yeah.
She's a nobody. She's nothing. She's not even in the historical, you know, picture at all. Like, and if you look at the Woodward book, she's not in there very much.
Yeah.
If you look at the Michael Wolff books, she's in there quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partially because of Bannon's influence and his particular distaste of her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's not Wolff's only source. And I think that, again, it's the palace intrigue aspect where she really gets involved. And the fact that she pushed out Kelly, you know, and maybe not her just on her own, but again, her and Jared and whatever other forces they could marshal, you know, she is going to continue to do that because she does not want anybody to stand between her and her direct access, right? So she kind of contributes to the chaos at the same time as she sees herself as a person who's bringing order.
So you've been around these types of people for a long time, both sort of personally and professionally, and I feel like nothing probably could surprise you at this point, but is there anything in your reporting about Ivanka that you were just like, whoa, what? No way.
Well, I mean, there was a bunch of stuff I couldn't report.
Yeah, of course.
That people told me off the record that was really, really good. But I mean, I think like the big thing is that like in her office, she has like, it's all white, right? Like it's white walls, it's a white chair, it's a white desk. It's like perfect. And then, you know, there's some coffee table books about like, you know, this and that impressionistic painter or whatever. And there's a book about Burning Man. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh my God. Like, on one hand, this makes perfect sense because, like, she just wants to network with, like, rich guys. And, like, where is better in the world?
Right. Oh, God.
Than networking with rich guys, like, for the Google guys and Zuckerberg and this one and that one. And then on the other hand, I was like, oh, maybe she, like, because she did do this thing. Like, she hiked by herself for 2 weeks alone in Chile. She just went camping with Jared the other day. Like, I actually was like, oh my God, I think she's going to show up at Burning Man. Like, I think she's actually wants to go have an acid trip and just be like, I'm trying to get back to my, you know, my ravey club self from 1999.
Oh, she's going to go do ayahuasca in Peru or something. That's going to
exactly.
be her thing.
I mean, that's for after the presidency. That's the purging part.
Vanessa Gregoriadis, host of Tabloid, The Making of Ivanka Trump. Thanks so much for chatting with us on The Gist.
Thank you for having me.
This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying, unflattering things about the war effort and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now, the spiel. The other day, I was scrolling through Twitter when a video popped up from The Hill, which is a political rag in D.C. where I live. It was a video of presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren. She was standing on a makeshift stage in front of a crowd somewhere in Minnesota. A giant American flag hung behind her. Apart from Warren's cool-ass Wayfarer sunglasses, nothing too remarkable there.
Hello, Minnesota! Dang, it is good to be here with all of you. It looks like Minnesota is ready for some change in Washington.
Pretty standard political rally fare. But what struck me about the video was her waving. Elizabeth Warren is the most enthusiastic waver I have ever seen. She held a wireless mic in one hand as she bounded across the stage like some sprightly woodland fawn. With the other hand, she waved furiously like she wasn't a 70-year-old woman with flappy bicep skin. Don't at me on this. Some of my favorite people are 70-year-old women with flappy bicep skin. Hi, Mom. But watching her, I was like, I'll have what she's having. I have never seen a political candidate so unencumbered by their body since Howard Dean let rip his infamous Dean scream.
We're going to California and Texas and New York, and we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan, and then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
We all know how well things ended for him after that whole I feel free in my body moment. I kept wondering as I watched the video, how is Elizabeth Warren able to move like she's the most pro-jazzercise candidate in the field? And I realized it's not because of Activia, though it might be. It's because of her clothes. Recently, NPR's Asma Khalid asked Warren about her campaign trail wardrobe.
I've been very intrigued by your fashion choices. Uh-huh. You have the black camisole look, and it's like a different colored blazer. Is that a conscious decision, or do you just...
Do you not want to text me to dress in the morning?
Yeah.
4 minutes.
Did you catch that? It takes her 4 minutes to get dressed. She says she's saving her decision-making capacity. The candidate, who has a reputation for having plans for just about everything, has even got a plan for how to efficiently get dressed in the morning.
Warren's busy making plans, y'all. She doesn't have time for fashion. The senator's outfits, if you can call them that, are the most brilliant form of athleisure. Biz yoga. I'm trademarking that, so don't even think about it. She wears black yoga-style pants, a black camisole, and some type of jewel-tone cardigan like the kind women who work in freezing-cold offices keep at their desks just in case. Liz generally pairs her biz yoga getup with some basic black boots, and bam, she's ready to high-kick into voters' hearts. She's like a wonky rocket. Now, talking about what professional women wear is fraught territory. I know. It's just an internet troll's hop-skip away from a game of hot or not, or worse. But I keep thinking about what it means that we're in a moment where we have six major presidential candidates who are women, people who are not resigned to the sartorial straitjacket that is the boxy navy suit and American flag lapel pin. I remember hearing this interview with Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who ran for her party's presidential nomination in 2012. She explained how it took her twice as long to get ready as her male counterparts because she had to look perfect for the cameras. And she explained that she had to pack a million outfits for the campaign trail lest the commentariat ding her for wearing the wrong thing to a barbecue or a town hall.
As a girl, it's completely different than as a man.
How so, with the events?
Well, because we would have to bring clothing changes with me.
How many clothing changes did you do?
Oh, I could do four a day.
Why?
Well, because it's media driven.
You can't be in the same outfit.
If I'm at an event, say, and well, it has to be appropriate to the event.
It wasn't vanity on her part. Bachman was the only female candidate in a crowded field of mostly white dudes, though shout out to Herman Cain and his double-breasted suits looking like a lawyer who was going to get you out of a DUI. The pundits and political gadflies were perfectly happy to skewer Bachman for how she looked, likely because there was no one else in the field who looked like her. But now there are six women in the race, though Marianne Williamson seems like an otherworldly being that might be above or beyond gender. But six women running for a major party nomination means that we can't spill a lot of ink over what secret message Kirsten Gillibrand's earrings are signaling or whether Amy Klobuchar's sensible heels would hurt if she threw one at us. If Liz Warren wants to pass yoga pants off as work slacks, I say, you go, girl. Six women also means we can't spend a lot of time interrogating their likability, which I have put in quotes, which you can't see. We can't judge whether they're that ridiculous combo platter of motherly authority, feminine confidence, and policy gravitas with a dash of sexy lady voice, though not too much. We can't collectively critique their hair or their clothes or their makeup. There's just no time. There are six women on the stump, and they all have important stuff to say. Even wackadoo Marianne.
Girlfriend, you were so on.
You know what else having six uniquely dressed women in the field means? That all those white guys are real hard to keep track of. Apart from human beanstalk Bill de Blasio and zygotic Boy Scout Pete Buttigieg, all the white guys who aren't Grandpa Joe or small s socialist Bernie are having a rough time. I can't tell a Bullock from a Bennett. I could distinguish woke daddy Jay Inslee from the pack, but that's because he deigned to wear a blue striped dress shirt and green tie during the debate. So daring. What I'm saying is that maybe we've reached a moment in this country's political maturation where female candidates for the highest office can be judged on leadership and action and ideas. What? No, that's crazy. And not for what's in their closet. Unless it's a bunch of skeletons, in which case I say judge away. Don't get me wrong. I love thinking about how we use clothes to telegraph certain things. Our creativity, our sexuality, our utter indifference to current fashion trends. We're all in some type of drag, using our clothing to paint a picture of who we would like to be and how we would like to be seen. In this way, clothing is power. We can construct our own narratives based in part by what we wear. And that's great news for women in politics, particularly the ones, plural, running for president. We're in a unique time in our history where these fierce femmes can define what a female president might look like. Men don't have that luxury. We have a fixed notion of male presidential attire. Bulky suit, navy, never gray, and God forbid tan, patriotic tie in red or blue, purple if you're that bozo who wants to signal how bipartisan you are, white shirt, black shoes, no glasses, no beard, despite how hard Ted Cruz tried to make his facial hair a thing. But future women presidents can wear cool sneakers and jeans like Kamala Harris, or political lady blazers like Tulsi Gabbard, or, a la Elizabeth Warren, they can throw a light cardi over their soul cycle kit, give 15 speeches, shake 9,000 hands, and still command a room. And the Oval Office. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced by Daniel Schrader and Pierre Bien-Aimé. Thanks to Pesca for letting me steer his ship for a day. Check me out on Twitter at Over and Out. Check my podcast out at Failure Show. Umperu, deperu, duperu, and thanks for listening. Do I actually have to do this thing? Umperu, duperu, duperu? Thanks for listening? Really? I looked it up. Yeah, it's the turkey penis Peru. Peruvian turkey penis. Yeah, yeah. All right, here I go. Watch me go.